As he tried to get his bearings, he moved from shadow to shadow. Kaydea lived at the western end of town, he remembered from long ago. Or at least she had lived out there. His legs moved swiftly and he didn't have to throw them by jerking his hips forward. His legs strode in balance, his feet planting firmly with each long running stride. He almost felt as if he were flying. And to him, this ability to run was almost as much of a leap as true flight would have been to a normal man. So rapt was he that he nearly forgot his purpose, and he had gone quite a long way before remembering Kaydale and the possible danger. He slowed, oriented himself, and realized that he had no idea where he was, for never in his life had he been west of Castle Pride. The farther he got from the castle, the more sparse lay the houses, scattered about small fields, clusters of simple houses separated by walls of piled rocks. All the structures looked the same, one or two-room hovels of plain stone with thatched roofs. A few had small gardens under their windows, flowers and vegetables with colors dull in the pale moonlight. Some of the houses had candles burning inside, and whenever he noted the lights, Branson slipped to the window and peeked in, hoping every time that he had at last found Kaydale's house. He walked for hours, all the lights going down, even the moon setting in the west, so that he was alone in the quiet dark. He went farther out than he had intended, out to where the houses were even more widely spaced, out where fields and forests dominated. Branson had no idea that Pride Town was this big, for there were certainly more houses here in the west than in the east, where he had grown up, where Garabon lived quietly with few and widespread neighbors around the small lake. Given the scope of the town, the young man only then realized the magnitude of the task before him in even finding Kaydale, let alone protecting her. Frustrated, but with the eastern sky beginning to brighten with the first light of dawn, Branson sprinted back along the roads toward Castle Pride, whose massive dark outline could be clearly seen even from this distance. The light was growing by the minute, and Branson realized that he might have erred. He understood clearly that he did not want to reveal his new secret. He did not want the monks or anyone else to know that there was another side to the storm. Each stride became more desperate as Branson realized that he wouldn't make it back to the chapel before the brothers had begun to stir. How would he explain himself? He thought of running right by, of going all the way out to Garabon's house, but his place was Chapel Pride, especially since he had one of their prized possessions, a magical gemstone, with him. He thought of the Book of Jest, about its lessons concerning breathing and stamina. He loosened his fists and let all his muscles relax, save those pumping his legs. He passed Castle Pride and moved to the side of the chapel, sidling up to one window in the room above his chamber. He peeked in and saw a couple of brothers sweeping and dusting.
Come along, Stork!
Branson fell back against the wall. He thought that perhaps he should just slip in and tell them the truth. And then he thought of the Book of Jest, the book that seemed to have the answers to everything buried in its graceful lines of script. Branson turned back and studied the two working monks, soon discerning their patterns, soon predicting their turns and movements. He found his timing and slipped over the stone sill and into the window. He reached the trapdoor and paused. As one brother lifted a candelabra from the desk, Branson lifted the trapdoor just enough so that he could slither through the opening. Now he moved fast to his bed, where he stripped and pulled the woolen tunic on. Last, and with great remorse, he removed his mask and the gemstone it held. He worried about keeping the stone for just a moment, until he realized that there had been several of the soul stones in the pouch after all, and the brothers didn't seem to keep close watch on them. Branson tucked everything out of sight, and not a moment too soon.
Come along, Stork. Daylight is wasting.
Branson rose from his bed, or tried to, and only then did he understand the toll his previous night's exploits had exacted upon his tortured body. Only distantly did he realize that he was being hoisted from the hole. Then blackness engulfed him. He awoke much, much later, with darkness again settling on the land. He was on a blanket on the floor of the room above his own, a monk sitting in a chair above him.
Kaydale.
Branson tried to roll over and rise, but before he even really began to pull himself up, the monk grabbed him by the shoulder.
Easy, Stork. It's almost dawn. Come on now. Go back to sleep. You had us all worried. We thought you had just decided to die. I suppose that might be a good thing for you, though, eh, Stork? Poor wretched thing. Might be that we'd all be better off, yourself most of all, in just giving you to Bernivigar. Ah, You poor thing.
Branson slumped back and hoped desperately that Kaydale was all right. He went through his duties absently the next day and was glad that the monks had reduced his workload since the incident with Tarkus Breen. When he finally managed to get back down into his hole, he was relieved to find that the monks had not found his hastily hidden black suit and the stolen soul stone. Realizing his limitations, Branson dared to slip out earlier that night. He had to move more carefully, as there were people around, but the sky was heavily overcast and the darkness gave him ample opportunity to hide. And he used the lessons of the book, the deeper understanding it offered of how individuals perceived their surroundings. As he fell into those woods, it almost seemed to Branson as if he could see the world through the eyes of those from whom he wished to hide, and moving past them without being noticed presented very little challenge. Branson felt as if he truly were just a two, as if the secrets of the mystics were more than simply known to him, but actually were a part of him. How could he move so gracefully with his newfound freedom so fresh? How could he run and fast when he had never done anything like that before? And yet, he knew how, as if he saw every movement of his muscles, as if he understood every twist and its result, as if his thoughts, his chi, had so perfectly aligned that his body had become a perfect extension of that life energy, perfectly guided. As he walked to the west end of Pride, Branson moved through the various routines of geste two fighting, working his arms in a series of movements both defensive and offensive. Many more lights were on as he moved through the western reaches of Pride Town, affording him a better chance to locate Kaydale. The shadow that was Branson drifted through the lanes and small yards, one by one, peering into house after house, and finally, he found her. She lived with her mother at the end of a lane in a small stone house with flowers all around the yard. She was inside, going about her nightly routines. Branson's heart leaped at the sight. He watched the two eat their dinner. He listened as they sat before the small hearth later, sometimes talking and sometimes sitting silent, taking in the meager heat on this unseasonably chilly night. When at last Kaydale rose and moved to a small cot and began to undress, Branson froze and nearly panicked. She pulled her tunic up, and Branson turned away. How he wanted to watch her, to bask in the beauty of her soft curves and delicate limbs. His curiosity and something deeper, something he didn't really understand, something deep in the base of his line of life energy, in his loins, tugged at him to watch. But he knew that it would be wrong. He stayed by the house until late in the night, protecting his dear Kaydale. And while he was there, he practiced the geste two exercises, the precise movements designed to instill memory and precision into the muscles of a warrior. Any geste two mystic watching him would have thought he had spent years at the Walk of Clouds. No trouble came to Kaydale that night, nor the next after that. And through each night, Branson was there, outside her house, keeping watch and examining, too, his newfound physical prowess and the implications that it might hold.
How will Master Bathalace and Brother Riondu accept this change? Or Bernivigar? Yes, the old one will be surprised and not pleased. What will he say when I look him in the eye and declare him a criminal? What will he say when I knock him down and kick him hard for the pain he brought Garibond? Garibond, my father of deeds, not blood. You will see your efforts rewarded. You will see your prayers answered. You will see your son stand straight. I will tend to you as you did for me all those years. Never again will you have to sit huddled in the cold rain, trying to catch a fish or two to silence your growling belly. Never again will you stagger toward the house, an armload of firewood in your weary arms. Never again, my father.
As he finished, Branson leaped high into the air and spun one leg flying out in a circular kick. He stopped abruptly and looked back at the house.
Kaydale, my love, my all.
A sudden stab of fear stole his voice. He thought he would rush forward and profess his love to her, tell her that there was nothing in all the world more precious to him than her smile and her gentle touch, that there was nothing warmer to him than the feel of her breath. He realized that she wouldn't reciprocate.
How could I begin to think myself worthy of you?
Instantly, his senses reached outward and caught the movements of several forms. Branson ducked into the shadows of a tree a dozen yards to the side of Kaydale's house. He stared back to the east, back down the lane and noted the approach of five dark forms. He couldn't make out any details from this distance, but he knew at once that it was Tarkus Breen and his friends.
This is why you came out here.
He caught a flash, a reflection of glass in the starlight, as the bottle soared and smashed against K-Dale's door. The three walked right past, taking no notice of him.
K-Dale! Come on out and play, girl! I've got a weapon too long sheathed!
The group strode right up to the house, one going left, another right, to ensure that no one got out. Everything seemed to move before Branson so slowly and yet very quickly, as if his mind couldn't properly take in the unfolding scene. He saw candlelight inside the house. He watched a large man walk up to the door.
What are you doing? Get out of my house!
Tarkus Breen and two others went in. He heard a scuffle, saw the two other men coming back around the house.
What are you doing? Get out of here!
K-Dale appeared at the door wearing only a white nightshirt. She started to run out, but Tarkus himself caught her by her thick hair and tugged her back. Branson shook violently. He silently cursed his cowardice. How could he watch this and not go to her? How could he stand here ready to pee in his pants?
Leave us alone!
Shut up, you old hag, and be glad you're too ugly to feel the sting of our weapons!
K-Dale crawled out and started to rise, but Tarkus's foot planted on her back and sent her sprawling to the ground. In a moment, four of the five were around her while the fifth remained inside with her mother.
You should know your place, girl. You interfere where you're not wanted. You defend that creature. Do you understand who we are, what we've done for you? Huh? We fight in the south and we die. We defend you, whore, and you side with that creature over us.
No!
You should welcome us with your legs wide. You should be honored that we think you're worthy of our seed. Take her!
K-Dale's tears, lines of wetness glistening in the starlight, crystallized Branson's thoughts. All his personal emotions fell aside in the face of that sight, of dear and wonderful K-Dale crying and broken, the surrender of the woman who had been one of the pillars of strength in his life. Branson slid to one knee as he came up on one of the men. Without breaking his momentum, he drove the heel of his right hand hard into the big man's groin. Branson leaped forward to land before Tarkus Breen. Breen's arm flashed out, a knife in his hand, but to Branson he almost seemed to be moving underwater. Branson snapped out his leg into the kneecap of the other attacker. Another of the men came forward, launching two clumsy punches. The third man went to the ground and Branson was already spinning. Around he went, sending his free leg into a circle kick. It was too high and cut the air above Tarkus Breen's head as he ducked and charged ahead, arm extended. But Branson's kick had been too high on purpose, in accordance with the movements taught in the Book of Jest. As Breen ducked, Branson launched his intended attack, his other foot snapping straight up into Breen's face.
Who are you? What do you want?
I am...
But what was he to say? He recalled some of the brothers at the chapel complaining that the roads were becoming unsafe again, with powries and highwaymen. He recalled pieces of their stories of old times and great deeds. He seized on that without even thinking.
I am the highwayman.
Tarkus Breen wasn't listening, Branson then realized, but had used the pause only so that he could gather himself for another attack. He came forward hard, slashing his knife back and forth, but Branson, though he had regained his awareness of himself, was no longer afraid. Branson caught Breen's wrist with his left hand. He lifted Breen's arm and went under it, turning it and forcing the bully to come up straight. Branson kept twisting as he stood up straight. He lifted his right arm and drove his elbow against Breen's. The look in Breen's eye, somewhere beyond pain, somewhere in the realm of shock and horror, was the first indication of something serious to Branson. He leapt back, letting go, and Tarkus Breen stood still, his right arm hanging at his side, his left hand coming in slowly, trembling every inch, approaching the hilt of his knife, which he had accidentally driven hard into his own diaphragm. Suddenly, Branson knew his enemy was dead. He knew that he had killed a man. He searched through the Book of Jest for an answer to this sudden realization. He tried to remember to breathe. Branson spun and charged into the house. A moment later, Callan staggered out, one eye swollen. She caught the door with one hand as she passed and managed to pull it partially closed behind her. She stumbled to K-Dale, who rose to embrace her. The door slammed closed, then exploded outward. the assailant flying through it backward. The highwayman appeared at the door.
Be gone, all of you! Be gone and return to this place only on pain of death!
They staggered and scrambled, hoisted their friend with the shattered kneecap, dragged Tarkas Breen's body, and managed to move away.
They'll not return.
How can we ever thank you?
No need, of course. I consider it an honor to be able to help.
Is everything all right? Should I call or what?
Branson smiled and tapped his hand to his forehead in salute.
Good evening to you, beautiful ladies. Blessed am I to be granted the good fortune to aid you this night.
But...
The look on your face is all the gratitude any man would ever need, and more than any man would ever deserve, m'lady. In all a man's life might he hope to see a single instance of such pure beauty as your face. I am the fortunate one this night.
The road back to the chapel was a long one for Branson. So many truths assailed him from every side. So many conflicting emotions. He had performed brilliantly. He had saved Kaydale and her mother, had beaten the bullies. He had killed a man. Out behind the castle, in the darker pre-dawn shadows within a copse of trees, Branson Garibond, the self-proclaimed highwayman, fell to his knees and threw up. The thrill of being out in the daytime had Branson smiling widely, almost giddily, below his black mask all the way out to the small lake in the west. When he had heard, so often after his return just before dawn, that all the monks had been summoned to the castle for the day, Branson couldn't resist the chance to finally go to his dear father's house. Now, he could hardly contain his joy when Garibond's house came into view. Gray lines of smoke rose from each chimney, which struck Branson as unusual, since Garibond typically only kept one hearth burning. He skipped from tree to tree, moving through the shadows and even up in the lower branches as he went. As he neared, he saw several forms moving around the small island, a pair of children and a pair of women, one of about his age and the other older, possibly her mother. Had Garibond taken a wife? Branson swallowed hard, not sure what to make of it all. Were these Garibond's children running about his island? And who was the girl of his own age? For surely she couldn't belong to his father. He moved even closer and rushed past the house to a pile of rocks on the shore, affording him a view of the southern side of the small island. Both women were heading that way, and now he saw why. A pair of men sat on the rocks down by the water, fishing. Branson had to consciously steady himself, for neither was Garibond. Where was Garibond? Who were these strangers that had come to his house? He started forward, thinking to go and ask them exactly that, but he paused, remembering his distinctive garments. It was one thing to be spotted running along the distant fields, but quite another to go right up to someone. And if he asked about Garibond, wouldn't he be implicating his father as an ally? He knew not what retribution might be in store for him for his actions at Kaydale's house. Was he to be branded a hero or an outlaw? He couldn't risk it, for Garibond's sake. He stayed in place for some time longer, taking a look at each of the six people on the island, committing their faces to memory. If they came into town, he would find a way to ask, he decided, or he would come back out here dressed in his woolen tunic and walking in the awkward guise of the stork. Yes, that might work. With the gemstone hidden, he could pretend to be the creature that everyone believed him to be. It was all too surprising and all too confusing, and the sun was low in the western sky. The monks would be returning soon after dinner, so he had heard. He sprinted back to the west.
Do these problems never lessen?
Pryday turned his angry look back at Banagran.
One man.
Banagran shrugged.
One man, unarmed, defeated five. Five who served with our warriors in the south and are not new to the ways of battle.
Those are the reports.
There were spearmen in the trees, perhaps.
There were no spear wounds, my liege. Nor were any cut, except Tarkas Breen, who died on his own dagger.
What of the other four?
Kearson will not walk again without a limp. But beyond that, they will all recover with time. Except for their wits, perhaps. For they claim the martial prowess of this one to be beyond belief. He was possessed of the strength of 10 men, they said, and he fought so quickly that it seemed as if there were 3 of him.
They would say that to save their drunken pride, though, wouldn't they?
Banagran shrugged.
Who was it?
He called himself the Highwayman.
Wonderful.
He is one man.
Who defeated 5 unarmed when they were not.
5 staggering drunks. Our guests are waiting. We should not linger. I doubt that Father Jerek will be able to remain much longer.
Does he even know where he is?
Doubtful. And if we don't get him out of here, it is likely he will shit himself soon enough.
Lead on.
Suddenly, Pryday reached out and grabbed Banagran's shoulder, stopping him.
We should go out in full splendor in the morning. It has been too long since I worked my chariot team.
A show of strength to assure the people.
And to warn this highwayman. Let him realize the terrible end of the road he has chosen to walk.
Chapel Pride was strangely quiet the next day as Branson went about his chores, collecting the chamber pots and setting them by the back wall. Not a monk seemed to be anywhere except the one who served as attendant to Father Jarek, and the old man himself, apparently worn out from the excursion of the previous day. Branson wasn't using the Soul Stone, though he missed it dreadfully. He had noticed, however, that even without the Soul Stone firmly secured against his forehead, he was finding a bit more control of his movements with every day. In gestitude terms, and using gestitude technique, Branson was finding more and more solidity to his line of chi. With his meditation and focus, he could form that line and hold it, albeit for only short periods, but even when he was not consciously engaged in such gestitude disciplines, he found that his line of life energy wasn't dispersing quite as widely and wildly as before. Given that, Branson found himself in the strange position of consciously exaggerating his stork-like movements. He wasn't quite sure why he should not reveal the changes he was experiencing, but he had a feeling that his cover as a helpless creature would serve him well for the time being. On his fourth trip to the back wall, Branson found the six previous pots still sitting there, untended and unemptied. He put the two new additions down and looked about curiously. Where was his helper? Branson moved back into the main areas of the chapel's first floor and was struck again by how empty the place seemed. Not a brother was to be seen or heard. He staggered through all the main rooms, finding them unoccupied. He went to the front door of the chapel, which was opened wide, and glanced out into the courtyard with its twin trees left and right of the cobblestone path. Curious, beyond any fear of breaking the rules or of simple good judgment, Branson moved down the chapel steps and across the courtyard to the open outer gate. He saw many of the monks lining the main road of Pride Town. He picked out Bathalace and Riandu among the throng, and it was indeed a throng, with all the folk out there. The stork made his awkward way to Riandu.
Stork, what are you doing out here? Never mind. Perhaps it is better that you came out. You should see the glory of Laird Pryday revealed.
First came the soldiers of Pride in their full regalia, bronze armor dully shining in the sunlight. They carried long spears holding them vertical, gleaming tips up high and in perfect alignment with one another. Behind the common soldiers came three horsemen, including one Branson knew well enough in the center. Banagran seemed even more huge and more imposing on his armored mount, and clearly the legendary warrior commanded the attention of all the onlookers. That is, until the man behind him appeared. In a chariot more grand than the one he had lost in the war all those years earlier, and with a team of two large and strong horses, Laird Pryday seemed the most splendid of all. He wore a new breastplate, replacing the many nicked one that had gone off to the Powry War. This one, again of bronze, and again emblazoned with the running wolves, was studded with jewels that caught the sunlight in bursts of radiance. He wore an open-faced helmet with a horsetail-like plume dyed red. But armor, helm, and chariot seemed not to matter much when he drew forth his shining steel sword. That sword could cut through a plate of bronze armor, so it was rumored, and it could fell a small tree with a single powerful stroke. That sword would keep the Powrys at bay and make any imperialistic-minded laird tremble at the mere thought of warring with Pride Holding. That sword was the sword of Branson's mother. The emotions sweeping through Branson as he watched the procession and the proud laird were very different from those of the people around him. They saw inspiration. They showed awe. But for Branson, there was only the sudden realization that this sword did not belong with the Laird of Pride. This sword, his mother's sword, was his own to claim. And so he would, he determined, and that very night. When the chapel monks had all settled into their beds, the highwayman, dressed in black, a soul stone pressed against his forehead by his tight mask, slipped out of Chapel Pride and moved through the shadows to the wall of the great castle itself, Branson watched the wall top for signs of sentries, trying to spot their dark silhouettes against the moonlit sky. All seemed quiet. He fell into his meditation, recalling the lesson in the Book of Jest, recalling the day he spent at the desk when he first took the Soul Stone. He considered the many revelations of the various gemstones, recalling the properties of malachite. Branson gathered his chi and lifted it, replicating the levitational energy of malachite. He felt almost as if he were floating, though of course he was not. But he was lighter, his life energy battling against the pull of gravity. Branson lifted a hand to the stone wall, found a slight finger hold, and propelled himself upward. Hand over hand he went, easily, spider-like. He reached the top of the wall in short order and glanced all around. With no guards in sight, he moved along the wall to the point where it joined with the large keep. This tower was Pryde's own, Branson had learned from various discussions among the monks over the years, and so this was likely where he would find his mother's precious sword. Again, he fell inside of himself and lifted his energy skyward, walking up the wall.
A fine show, my liege. Every now and then, they need to be reminded.
Branson recognized the speaker as none other than Bernivagar.
Perhaps it is a reminder that I need as well.
It struck Branson that the Laird's voice was quite somber.
I do not miss the sound and smell of battle. Yet I cannot dismiss the thrill that courses my body when I drive my chariot and draw my sword.
It gives hope to the people. You are their protector.
And their Laird, with all the privileges that entails. The woman you chose along the parade route awaits you in your chambers, my liege. Use her well.
My blood is hot with the sound of trumpets and cheers. Perhaps this, at long last, will be the night for the consummation.
Branson held his position and glanced all around and down. Still, he saw no guards walking sentry. After a few more moments of silence, he slipped into the room. He moved away from the window, crouching in the darkness and allowing his eyes to adjust. Gradually, the distinctive shapes within the room came into clearer focus. The closed door across the way, the chairs before the hearth off to his left, the hearth itself, and something set on the wall above the hearth. Silent as a shadow, he slipped to the hearth and saw the outline on the wall. It was a sword. A long sword, too long for bronze or iron. Branson swung around to see a surprised Banagrand standing just inside the door, torch in hand and wearing only a tunic and loose breeches.
Was it the Ancient Ones of Samhaste, or the Blessed Abel that put you here in my grasp?
The large man set the torch into the bracket beside the door.
For truly such good fortune as this falls within the realm of divine miracle.
Branson sprang over the chair behind him, putting more ground and now two chairs between himself and the charging warrior. The mighty warrior waded in. A couple of glancing blows clipped him, but only at first, only while he was acting with his conscious mind instead of letting himself fall into the teachings of the Book of Jest. Now, Branson dared to counter, getting his hands up inside Banagrand's punch, deflecting it, and launching one of his own. Banagrand pressed on, and as he stepped forward, he dropped his right shoulder and launched a roundhouse punch that seemed to come from his ankle, his heavy right hand swooping in for the side of the highwayman's head. It was a perfectly executed block, a detailed maneuver in the Book of Jest, but neither that book nor the highwayman had taken into account the strength difference between the diminutive Branson and the giant and powerful Banagrand. He launched a wide flying right hook. Branson ducked it, dropping so low that his butt nearly touched the ground. Up he sprang into the air, lashing out with his feet, one and then the other. The attacks barely fazed the big man, and now he was altering the angles of his strikes, high and low, and seemed perfectly willing to accept Branson's stinging counters. A left jab snapped in, and Branson turned it, retracted his hand and started a counter. Then he saw the blood pouring from his fingers, and then he noticed that Banagrand's hand was no longer empty. Branson leaped back, glancing from the cut to Banagrand to the long knife that the man now held. Banagrand charged ahead, stabbing hard, but Branson went around the outstretched arm in a quick roll, then sprinted past the man for the wall. Banagrand turned to pursue, then watched in amazement as the highwayman seemed to run right up the wall, springing directly over him in a twisting somersault. The highwayman landed lightly, and a second leap brought him to the top of an overturned chair. He sprang away again, gathering momentum in a great leap that sent him flying across the room. He landed right before the hearth, grabbed the magnificent sword by the pommel, and turned to face Banagrand.
You drew first. I was content to embarrass you with an open hand. Now it seems I must kill you. Which will you pray to, mighty Bonagran? The Ancient Ones or Blessed Abel?
The highwayman took a fast step forward, thrusting the blade, but Bonagran leaped back, caught her chair by the arm and whipped it across to Blunt. Then, with strength beyond anything Branson had ever seen, the big man stopped his swinging arm suddenly and threw the chair. Bonagran hadn't pursued. He had run back to the open door.
Guards! Get in here now!
Branson ran to the window, turned to salute the big man.
We too will fight again, sword to sword or fist to fist.
Like a spider, the highwayman moved to the side of the window and then up. He reached the top and pulled himself over. The head of a guardsman poked out the window below and began looking all around at the ground.
Did he fall?
Branson put his back against the crenellated tower top and lifted the gleaming sword before his eyes. He felt the smooth steel and the keen edge and marveled at the beauty of the etchings running the length of the blade. This was the work of his mother as surely as the copy of the Book of Jest had been created by his father. He understood completely that this was no ordinary weapon, and from more than the exotic feel of the materials. The balance, the delicate work along the pommel, the light yet solid feel of the blade all hinted to him of the marvels within and of the discipline required to create this. He knew that his mother had made it, for he could feel her residual energy within the blade. The Book of Jest had referred to weapons such as this and spoke about the bonding between the craftsman and the weapon. But only now could Branson truly come to appreciate that truth. For in holding this magnificent sword, Branson felt as if he were touching the mother he had never known. A weight of responsibility fell upon Branson then. His mother was a Jester II mystic, an accomplished warrior and philosopher. He had much to live up to. As he continued to hold and contemplate the sword, he felt a warm, clear sensation that his mother was pleased, that she was looking down on him now and was glad that her sword was in the hands of her son, the child for whom she had willingly offered her own life force. A long time later, the commotion around the castle died down, but Branson could still see groups of soldiers with torches scouring the area. He poked a loop for the sword in the tied waistline of his trousers, gathered his inner strength, and climbed down the wall. Moving from shadow to shadow, the highwayman was soon back in the chapel and soon back in his little room, and now he had one more thing he knew he must keep hidden. The lines were not as intricate and flowing, but the patterns of the words were much the same. Branson focused hard to keep his head from lolling about so that he could study those patterns and try to make some sense of them. It wasn't often that Branson got any opportunity to view the writings of the monks. On those occasions when he was the highwayman, he spent very little time in the chapel, only enough to get in and out along a direct route from his trap door to the window and back again. So this morning, going about his rounds, when he saw the parchment unrolled and weighted down on the desk, Branson quickly moved to inspect it. He stood there for a long time, staring down at the script and wondering if he might somehow teach himself.
Take care with that. Taking respite from your work?
No,
Still intrigued by words?
Branson nodded.
Please do not drool on this, my little friend. Do you know what this is?
Branson tried to shake his head, but it went in a circular motion instead and sent his eyes spinning.
It details instructions from the masters of my order, from Chapel Abel itself, where the prophet taught and where he died. Perhaps one day I will find the means to take you there. Yes, you would like Chapel Abel. It is set on a high cliff, overlooking the dark, rolling waters of the ocean. Waves smash against the rocks continually like the thunder of God himself. You cannot stand atop that cliff without seeing the beauty of a Godstalk. You feel small and great at the same time, as if you were a part of something larger and more wonderful than yourself, than your life itself. The thunder of the waves pounds like the heartbeat of God, I tell you. You would like to see that place, wouldn't you?
Branson nodded eagerly and grinned from ear to ear, but the smile went away almost immediately as he came to consider what any journey away from Chapel Pride might do. How could he take his clothing, the sword, and the stolen gemstone with him? How could he keep his secret, or find the hours of freedom in the guise of the highwayman? He caught himself in those thoughts and glanced anxiously at Riandu, who, thankfully, had not noticed his changing mood. Quickly, Branson shifted the focus and the conversation by pointing emphatically at the parchment.
An order from Chapel Abel. Oh. The world is a difficult place right now, Stork. Men are warring across the land of Haunts as the lairds vie for supremacy and allegiance. And we of Blessed Abel are caught in the middle. We are healers, not warriors, but some of the lairds wish us to use our gemstone powers to help them in their battles. And indeed, many of the brothers are doing just that. And of course, after the battles, we toil endlessly over the wounded. And thus come the troubling decisions concerning the disposition of the wounded. Are we to heal only those men who fight for our own lairds? Are we to ignore the cries of the enemy wounded? I do not know if I could do that, Stork. I do not know if I could allow a man to die, knowing that I might have healed his wounds. But it is not my decision, so declare the masters of Chapel Abel. The decree before you states that we are to heed the desires of our laird regarding the wounded. If Laird Priday insists that we let the enemy wounded suffer and die, then we must abide by his decision. Do the colors a man wear so determine the value of the man? Does allegiance to a laird mean anything more to a peasant than the happenstance that he was born in the holding of that laird? Would a man of pride serve Laird Ethelbert with equal fervor if he had happened to be born in Ethelbert holding? I think so, Stork. And so I am saddened by the choice of my masters.
Branson looked back at the parchment, seeing it, suddenly, in a very different light. If the monks of Blessed Abel were truly God-inspired, as they claimed, then how could they abrogate their moral imperatives to the decision of a secular man? It seemed a cowardly thing.
Practicality has its place, I suppose. Fortunately, the battle has not yet reached us here in Pride Town, and with good fortune, and the aid of Laird Delaval's thousands, it never will. Come along, Stork. You cannot avoid your duties.
Branson lifted the room's chamber pot with one hand and offered his free arm to accept Riando's guiding hand, and he shuffled along beside the monk toward the room's open door. But he was not willing to let go of this rare encounter with Riando.
Garibond.
Branson made sure that he watched Riando closely as he spoke Garibond's name, knowing, as was detailed in the Book of Jest, that a man's initial reaction was often more telling than his subsequent words. And, indeed, Brother Riando's eyes did flash and widen for just an instant before he got himself steadied.
Garibond? Ah, yes, old Garibond, a good man, a good man. He went to the south, I believe. Yes. Yes, to Ethelbert, from what I have heard. The sea air would be gentler on his aching bones, so he said.
Branson wasn't entirely convinced, and he only half listened, focusing instead on the man's expressions and inflections as Riando continued to tout the healing aspects of salty air and went on about the better, warmer, and sunnier climate of Ethelbert compared to Pride. Of course, Branson knew, the monks could simply have offered Garibond healing sessions with their gemstones. He didn't press the point, and he showed no outward sign of his doubt as he and Riando exited the room and moved along toward the next door in the hallway. But then monks were rushing all around, responding to a commotion down the hall the other way, near the main chamber of the chapel's first floor. Immediately, Riando reversed direction, pulling Branson along with him. They came to the end of the corridor to see many of the brothers assembled in line before Master Bathalace in the main chamber, with Laird Priday himself and several soldiers facing them.
Stay here.
Riando rushed out to join Master Bathalace. Branson watched as Banagran moved along the line of monks, lifting and inspecting their hands. The young man's eyes widened as he realized what was transpiring there, and he lurched over, placing the chamber pot down hard, then dipping his hand into its brown contents. He came back up fast as he could, holding the pot once more in his filthy, shit-covered fingers. Fingers that had been cut by Banagran's knife the night before. How glad was Branson that Brother Riando had not apparently noticed the scar, the cut healed by the stolen soulstone and the meditation of Jest, but still visible. Banagran finished with the monks then, and noticed Branson as he turned back to his liege. He paused and studied the damaged young man.
He thinks I am the right size.
Banagran started to approach, and Branson fought hard to remain calm. He wished that he had his soulstone with him, that he could become the highwayman if need be, and flee this place. He thought he was surely trapped.
But Banagrand stopped suddenly and looked down at Branson's hand in the chamber pot. The large man gave the stork a dismissive wave, then went back to join Priday, Bathalace, and Riandu. Bathalace dismissed the monks then, and they began to disperse. Branson used the distraction to shamble along the general direction of the leaders.
Surely you do not believe any of the brothers hold any complicity in this theft?
There was no rope. No sign of rope.
It is hard to believe that anyone could steal the sword and so easily flee the 40 feet down the side of the tower. Unless, of course, the thief had the aid of a magical gemstone.
Malachites. We have but two, I believe, in all of Chapel Pride.
And where are they?
Riandu looked at Bathalace.
I will order a complete inventory of all of our gemstones. All of them. And I assure you that if any are missing, our aid will prove invaluable to you. There are ways to detect the usage of gemstone powers, my lad.
Are you so careless with your sacred gemstones that you know not even where all of them are now placed?
We are no less vested in our gemstones than you are in your magnificent sword, my lad. We will account for them all, I assure you. If an outside contraband stone has been brought into the region by this man, this...
Highwayman.
This highwayman creature, there is no tolerance for this within our order. Any man found with a contraband gemstone will suffer the full wrath of the Church of Blessed Abel.
A man not of the Church in possession of a stolen gemstone is declared heretic and burned at the stake.
Perhaps I will allow you that pleasure, if indeed this thief holds such a stone. But not until I am finished with him, and know that he will welcome the consuming flames when I have shown him my wrath.
Branson nearly tumbled to the ground and felt as if he would throw up. Somehow he managed to get out of the room without attracting any more attention to himself. What was he to do? Had he gone too far? Could he possibly explain to the brothers why he had borrowed the Soul Stone? Unsure of himself, not knowing what to do next, the terrified man continued with his duties. The guise of the stork would protect him, he tried to convince himself. How could they suspect him of anything when he could hardly walk? Several days passed before Branson dared to go out as the highwayman again, days made longer by his burning desire to test his mother's magnificent sword. Now that he had it firmly in hand, moving through the training movements he had learned in the Book of Jest, Branson began to understand just how wonderful the weapon truly was. It felt as if it were an extension of his arm as he swung it. Its balance remained perfect at nearly every angle, making it seem even lighter than it was. And although it was much longer than the average Hans bronze or iron sword, the thin steel blade of Senui's creation was far lighter. Branson spent an hour and more playing with the blade, weaving cuts against imaginary opponents, defeating attacks and quickly countering with killing strikes. Even when he finished the most taxing of practice routines, he was full of energy and brimming with eagerness. He had no destination in mind this night, so he glided through the shadows, taking in the sights, the sounds, and the smells of Pride Town.
But what am I to feed my children this night?
You have more. You know you do. I told you 3 days ago to be ready for this.
But my husband's not returned from the south.
Then get on without him. Do you believe that any are having an easy time of it with the war, selfish woman?
Branson came up over a small grassy mound to take in the sights of the argument. A peasant woman, dirty and dressed in rags, was practically on her knees before one of Laird Priday's soldiers, who had a bulging sack slung over one shoulder while he kept her at bay with his other arm.
Oh, just give me food for the night, then, so I won't be going to bed hungry.
He watched the soldier kick the peasant woman as she scrambled back toward her hovel. The soldier turned away and started back toward Castle Pride. The highwayman circled him, moving to a tree and pulled up it and onto a branch overhanging the road.
A fine night of thievery, I see.
The man stopped quickly, drawing his short sword.
Who said that?
An admirer.
The soldier stopped and followed the voice to the tree that held the highwayman.
Truly, I do admire one who has found a way to so easily steal that which he desires. It shows cunning and efficiency, I think.
Steal? Bah, I'm no thief. This is the Laird's business, and none of my own.
Laird Priday bids you to eat your booty?
Get yourself going and be quick! No time to suffer, a fool. You interfere with the Laird's tax collectors on penalty of death.
Oh, but I am already so marked.
The highwayman dropped from the tree, landing a few paces in front of the soldier.
Do you not know who I am?
You!
Curiously said. Could I not claim the same of you?
You're him!
Again, my point holds.
You come with me. In the name of Laird Priday, I arrest you. Come on, then. I've been fighting in the south for a year now, and think nothing of cutting you up.
The highwayman glanced around as if he meant to run away. The soldier, predictably, rushed ahead, the tip of his sword barely inches from the highwayman's chest.
Now! Last chance to surrender before I run you through.
The highwayman feigned fright and presented his sword horizontally before him. When the soldier reached for the offered blade, the highwayman tossed it up into the air. The highwayman caught his blade as it fell and leaped forward in a spin, whacking the soldier's feebly presented sword cross. Then he rolled behind the blade and up the man's arm, timing his turn perfectly so that he could drive his left elbow into the side of the man's face.
I will hear your sword hit the ground, or I will hear the last breath of your life.
Up came the highwayman's knee into the soldier's groin.
The first rule of battle is to know your enemy. The second is to prepare the battlefield. And the third is to make certain that your enemy thinks you are less formidable than you are. Although I admit such a tactic would be difficult to present for one of your lack of skill. But you have learned, perhaps. I suppose that if we ever meet again, you will not be so easily deceived. On that occasion, regretfully, I will likely have to kill you. Of course, if you stubbornly persist now, we will never meet again in this lifetime.
Sometime later, the naked soldier, his arms twisted and bound behind his back with his own torn clothing, a tight gag tied in place, stumbled to the front gates of Castle Pride. Sometime later, the peasant woman found a cache of food inside the one small window of her house, as did several of her equally hungry neighbors. Sometime after that, a voice awakened Kaedale.
Hello, beautiful.
When she went to the window to investigate, she saw a bright smile below a black silk mask.
Here, eat well with your mother this evening.
The highwayman handed in a worn sack of food.
What are you doing?
I met with one of Laird Pryde's thugs. The Laird has enough to eat, I think.
What, you stole it?
Well, it sounds harsh when you speak of it like that. I prefer to think of it as seeing to the Laird's flock in the name of Pryde himself, and representing his better and more generous side.
If we are caught with this...
Then eat it. Laird Pryde's men cannot see into your belly, now can they?
Well, you play a dangerous game.
Oh, that makes it more fun. Eat well, beautiful Kaedale.
She pressed the food close to her breast, and she could feel the excited flutter of her heart. The highwayman danced away through the shadows, spinning his sword and leaping into battle against imaginary foes. He knew not why he had acted as a thief this night, knew not why he had suddenly taken this more dangerous fork in the road, but he couldn't deny the lightness of his step, the rush of blood throughout his body, or the thrill of his mischief. Yes, he knew. He was the highwayman, who defended the woman he loved, who took back his mother's stolen sword, and who, it now seemed, would not suffer the unfairness of Pryde's rules. The image of gratitude on the faces of those he had fed this night was better than wine as he danced his way across Pride Town and back to the quiet chapel.
All the town speaks of him.
More than a month had passed since the theft of Pryde's precious sword, which was now being used weekly by the outlaw highwayman, usually in stealing from Pryde's tax collectors and even some of his soldiers. The lone bandit was striking haphazardly, without any discernible pattern. Every time he seemed to simply appear out of the darkness, quickly dispatch of any offered defenses, and thus far in a non-lethal, though usually painful manner, take what booty he could and melt away back into the night.
They exult in the glory and cunning of the highwayman.
Not openly.
No. That is all the more troubling. He is feeding them, you know. He is taking the requisitioned food from lawful collectors and distributing it among the peasants.
We do not know that, my liege. And if we find any such evidence, rest assured that the offending peasant will be punished.
You know that he is doing that, Barnacran! This miscreant, this common thief, becomes a hero among the people by throwing them a few scraps of food. And these disloyal dogs fall for the ploy. How fickle is their allegiance!
Times difficult for the common folk, my liege. So many are off to the south, never to return, and our demands sorely press those remaining. Many families are headed now by the mother alone, not even with an older son to help her in the fields.
Laird Delaval presses me hard.
They have little to eat.
They have as much as our warriors battling Ethelbert in the south!
Should I deny food and clothing to men spilling their blood so that these peasants, hungry though they are, might live more comfortably?
I am not arguing, my liege, but merely trying to explain why this highwayman creature has so easily found the hearts of many.
I want him caught. I want him dragged to the castle and burned alive.
The people will frown upon you.
Upon me? Nay. The execution of this one will fall to our Bell brothers, or to Bernivagar, if not them. Either way, he will die.
Deservedly so.
Prince Yeselnik, favored nephew of Laird Delaval, is on his way. Double the scouts upon the road and send patrols of the castle guard out to the ends of Pride Town each night. Offer a reward for any whispers that lead us to this knave. We must put an end to this before the legend of the man grows and before Laird Delaval comes to know that we harbor such a secret.
Panagran kept his expression impassive as Laird Priday fell into the chair across from him, drawing a curious stare from his liege.
What?
A slight smile turned up the corners of Banagran's mouth.
What?
He strikes in the dark, from behind and by surprise, and against men ill-prepared to defeat him. We learn from his every attack, and we will become better prepared.
You are right, my friend. He is one man, one prickly thorn that we shall pluck and discard soon enough.
What will Yeselnik Delaval ask of us?
More food, more gold, more iron, and more men, likely. The fighting in the south has not let up at all, and there is word that Laird Delaval has sent warriors to support the people at Palmaris Town in their battle against the wild tribes of the north and west.
He should focus his strength against Ethelbert first, and drive the man back before offering any truce. This has gone on far too long already.
Would that he would.
Kaydale walked along the road to her house one dark night, her stride easy and her posture showing that she was unafraid. That calm demeanor was not unnoticed by the people in the neighboring houses, most of whom dared not venture outside after dark. For the young woman, her own realization that she was unafraid struck her suddenly. Bandits were all around the roads of Pride, and Powries had been seen in several areas. One group had attacked some men not far from this very area, but Kaydale knew that she was not alone. A small sack plopped to the ground before her. It fell open, and an apple, shiny, even in the starlight, rolled out. Kaydale looked up to the tree to see a now familiar and not unexpected figure sitting astride a low branch, leaning back against the trunk.
You should not be out after dark. You never know what knaves might find you and ravish you.
Kaydale blushed and was glad of the darkness. The highwayman, though he was at least 15 feet up, swung his leg over the branch and dropped down, landing easily, knees bending to absorb the impact. He stood up straight before Kaydale, his smile wide as it always seemed to be when he was with her.
Well, are you not going to accept my gifts?
Kaydale put her hands on her hips and stared at him defiantly.
You'll not share your ill-gotten goods with the man who ill-got them for you?
Kaydale couldn't resist, her expression brightening as she took the apple in the sack. She looked inside the bag, confirming her suspicions when she noted the glisten of shiny coins among the remaining food.
Money?
I have no need of it.
If I go to market and spend it, I will draw suspicion. No one has extra coins with Laird Priday's tax collectors all about. Not unless they're hiding it from the Laird, and that's not wise.
People spend money in the market every day.
But not so much.
Then spend it a bit at a time. Buy something for your mother.
Why do you do this?
Do what? You need the food, so I give it to you.
No, I mean, why do you do all of this? You live in the shadows of the night. What of the day?
I am alive every day.
Do you serve with Laird Priday's garrison? Are you a farmer? Did you fight in the war?
Are you an agent for the Laird?
Oh, God, you are impossible.
Not so, my lady. I am here.
The Laird is not happy with you.
I would not expect him to be. In fact, I would be disappointed if I learned that he was.
Soldiers!
Before she could react, the highwayman grabbed her by the shoulder and pulled her from the road, the two of them rolling into the depression off to the side. And not a moment too soon, Kaydale realized, as a trio of soldiers came galloping past.
The Laird is not happy with me. I thought it best that you'd not be seen speaking with me.
But you can't just...
Kaydale suddenly realized how close she was to this man, their bodies intertwined, his breath warm on her face. He, too, seemed suddenly caught up in the moment, and Kaydale wondered if he would kiss her. And she realized that she hoped he would, but he didn't. He rose and helped her up, then brushed himself off as she did likewise.
Why do you do this?
He stared at her for a long while, his face sober, his eyes so dark and sparkling, locked onto her.
Because it is right.
Kaydale had no idea of where to take the conversation from there.
Because it is right.
She rolled those words over and over in her mind. She had heard many of her neighbors say such things, had even seen a few of them do such things on occasion, but never, in all her life, had Kaydale heard or seen that particular concept expressed by a man in power.
Because it is right.
So simple, and so elusive.
Sleep well this night, my lady. Dare I hope that you might dream of me?
The bold question had Kaydale back on her heels, but as it was accompanied by one of the man's typical sassy smiles, she let it go with a grin of her own. He took her hand and kissed it, then bowed to her and danced away, leaping into the night and disappearing.
Because it is right.
The words followed Branson, too, as he made his way across the town and back to Chapel Pride. It had been a good answer, he knew, and one that had certainly seemed to impress Kaydale. But was it true? Branson chewed his lip as he considered that. The teachings of the Geste Thieu demanded introspection and honest self-evaluation, and the Book of Geste had shown him many techniques to strip away the inevitable defenses that any person would construct against such painful personal intrusion. Branson studied his feelings honestly. He recalled how he felt during all his actions these last weeks as the highwayman. He knew, and came to understand even more with every step, that his efforts weren't quite as magnanimous as he had made them seem with that answer. There was the matter of pride. There was the matter of his love for Kaydale. Yes, he felt proud when he rescued someone from bandit, powry, or tax collector alike, or when he saw the smile of gratitude on the face of a peasant after the heroic highwayman had offered some food to quell the grumbling of his belly. He knew that pride was a failing. The Book of Geste often referred to it as the downfall of great men. But there it was. When he had answered Kaydale, Branson had to fight hard to resist blurting out the truth. How he wanted to tell her that he loved her, and had loved her since he was just a boy, when he was the stork, and she would help him off the ground, when she chased the bullies away. He had almost said it, but he was too afraid. What would Kaydale think of the dashing highwayman if she knew that he was really the dirty stork? So perhaps there were some personal reasons for his choices of late.
Because it is right. Well, it is right, is it not? I am helping people desperately in need, as some have helped me. Would Garibald do any less?
Satisfied with that, Branson crept back through the window of the chapel, across the room, and into his hole. He had defeated the demon of introspection and self-evaluation and fell to his cot with a warm memory of Kaydale beside him. He hadn't reached for the deeper self-evaluation, however, hadn't gone to the dark place in his heart where festered his frustration and anger, memories of his years of torment, thoughts of the missing Garibald and the horrible Bernivagar who had once mutilated the man, and resentment at his continuing ill-treatment by the brothers who had taken him in and would not teach him to read. It all sat there, buried within, quietly waiting.
The Saga of the First King is continued on the next disc.